The third case this morning is United States v. Moody. Mom?
May it please the court, counsel. At this point, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. It was plain error for the jury to have considered the privately stored electronic data that Mr. Moody kept and maintained on his personal cell phone. First, the Fourth Amendment in case law protects such data. Second, there was no applicable warrant exception that would have justified Officer Rogers' unwarranted search of Mr. Moody's private cell phone data. And third, the admission of this privately stored electronic data adversely affected Mr. Moody's substantial rights, as well as his trial and sentencing, resulting in an unfair and unduly long sentence. The verdict and sentencing should be overturned, and this court should order a new trial. The first reason the conviction should be vacated is that officers needed a search warrant to retrieve the coded, privately stored name and phone number in Mr. Moody's cell phone address book. A modern cellular phone is a quintessential personal item of the modern age. Even the most basic modern cell phone can be a day planner, a diary, a photo album, a camera, a list of friends, a catalog of intimate conversations, a repository of every detail of a person's life.
What did they look at?
They looked at his cell phone address book and retrieved the name and phone number of one of his contacts.
Was Misty, what's her name on there?
The record does not reveal whether Misty Sutton was in his address book. The only detail that was revealed is that he retrieved the information for G, or Gonzalo Gutierrez, who was Mr. Moody's supplier.
What I'm curious about is whether Misty, whatever her name was the informant, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and there was a call from her, as I understand it.
Misty Sutton let the officers know that that Mr. Moody would be might be carrying methamphetamine. The record does not reveal, to my knowledge, whether there was any calls related to Misty Sutton present in the address book, or that they were looking for that. The only contact discussed in the testimony is the one for Gonzalo Gutierrez.
I guess that's my curiosity then, because if there was a previous call from her identified in that search, and then anything subsequent to that might be something of interest as part of this process, that's all.
Okay. To my knowledge, Your Honor, the record does not reveal any such call. Citizens have a reasonable expectation of privacy in a cell phone stored contents. And to retrieve that private data, law enforcement officers are necessarily intruding onto a personal information space that is protected by the Fourth Amendment. Courts have consistently required warrants to search privately stored electronic data when stored on personal computers. Cell phone data, like computer data, is privately stored electronic data and should be subject to the same Fourth Amendment protections. There is no current debate that a warrant is necessary to search data stored on a personal computer. And in short, individual privacy is not about location or physical space. It is about information, what information about ourselves we wish to reveal and what we do not. Technology has opened a vast informational space in each one of our pockets in the form of our cell phone. It is time to recognize that absent exigent circumstances, a warrant is required to search a cell phone to adequately protect personal privacy interests under the Fourth Amendment. Like computer data, the data in Moody's phone was entered by Moody, kept in his personal data storage device for his own use. He even took steps to protect that data. He coded the letter G instead of the full contact name Gonzalo Gutierrez. Here, Moody had a reasonable expectation that the data would be kept private. In Park, Wall, Quintana, and McGee, courts recognized the electronically stored data cannot be retrieved merely by lifting a container lid. In Wall, the Southern District of Florida court said, and I quote, "Searching through information stored on a cell phone is analogous to the search of a sealed letter, which requires a warrant." The McGee court in the District of Nebraska said, and I quote, cell phones may now contain a vast amount of private information. McGee had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of his cell phone.
Well, what did he get? What did they do with it? Because obviously with technology, you know, I saw an article today about Stingray. That's pretty baffling about what that can do. I think, what is it, the Supreme Court going to hear about attaching GPS to the car? Isn't that coming up here in a few days?
I have heard something about that, Your Honor.
Yeah, so, you know, this is an ongoing thing, and I'm probably the least qualified to talk about technology, but there's so much going on now that it just expands out. And I'm wondering, can we look at this at least on focus on what they got and what they did with it, as opposed to going through whatever? I don't have any idea of the capacity of that phone several years ago. Nowadays, of course, it does everything. Maybe his phone did or didn't. If it's like mine, I never turn it on, but that's beside the point. So what did they get, and what did they do with it?
What they got was the name and telephone number of Mr. Moody's supplier in this conspiracy that he was ultimately charged with. This was the first time in the record that there was a link between Andre Moody and Gonzalo Gutierrez, who was his supplier in the conspiracy. This happened.
Isn't it almost in hindsight? What did they do with it over a period of time with that G and a telephone number?
Well, the timeline in the record would reveal that happened in November of 2007. In 2009,
2 years later.
Two years later, the cell phone records of Moody and Gutierrez were subpoenaed to show additional contacts between them. There was a meeting at a gas station observed between Moody and Gutierrez, presumably to exchange money and narcotics. And Gutierrez was arrested and searched subsequent to that meeting on a traffic stop. It is clear that all the links that provided the grist for the conspiracy between Moody and Gonzalo Gutierrez flowed from this initial 2007 traffic stop and illegal search.
You're saying all these things that happened in 2009 would not have happened without that 2007 discovery?
There's certainly nothing in the record to indicate they would have, Your Honor. From the record, it would appear that in 2007 there was this search, and it wasn't until 2009 that any further links between Moody and Gutierrez were explored, developed, or anything of the sort. There is simply no reason to believe that absent this search, those links would have been developed at all.
So there's really, we don't have anything in between 07 and 09, one way or the other, I guess.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And critically on that point, this is really the linchpin of the entire conspiracy. You've had, you know, Andre Moody and Gonzalo Gutierrez as his supplier, and then all these other various actors. And without that link, it's not clear that you could come to the same conclusion regarding the conspiracy. It starts to look much like a bunch of small-time meth transactions in a small town rather than this large-scale distribution operation, which you have when you have this link to Gonzalo Gutierrez. This court in the Mann case last year, while finding a computer search to be within the scope of an existing warrant, found it troubling that no additional warrant was procured to look for evidence of a different crime. This shows that this court recognizes the Fourth Amendment protection of privately stored electronic data of the sort that Mr. Moody would contain in his cell phone, namely address book, contacts, and that sort of thing. And on the subject of technology, it is important to note here, the storage capacity of cell phones is only getting larger. They are becoming more like computers every day. And even Mr. Moody's cell phone was enough like a computer in its data storage capacity to warrant Fourth Amendment protection as such. The second reason the conviction should be vacated is that there was no applicable legal exception to Officer Rogers' search of Mr. Moody's cell phone. Namely, there was no vehicle search, no search incident to arrest, or exigent circumstances exceptions, nor was the information revealed to a third party. There were no exigent circumstances because Mr. Moody and his phone were in custody. Moody cooperated during the vehicle search, and there was no risk of flight or danger of destruction of evidence. In other words, no facts support an Ortiz-like analysis because there was no evidence that the contact G in Moody's address book would have been destroyed, deleted, or compromised had that search not occurred.
As you said, he and his phone were in custody?
Yes, Your Honor.
What happens if they're both released, though, he and his phone?
Certainly, they were eventually released subsequent to the search, but no one is denying, Your Honor, that the police would have the authority to seize the cell phone and wait for a warrant if they, in fact, had probable cause to support one.
Now, if they had not seized it, just released he and his phone.
Indeed, but I don't see why they would, Your Honor, given that if they believed there was something in there, they would have presented their probable cause to a magistrate and obtained the warrant. There was no reason, I don't believe, that they would have released him with his phone if they were waiting on important evidence. This court noted in Ortiz that when discussing pager data, that it could be destroyed by pushing a button, doing nothing, and having merely incoming calls erase evidence of the old calls, or turning off the device. This sort of pager precedent, I don't think, is applicable to this case because there's nothing in the record to show the G entry was at risk of deletion. In a cell phone, it requires an active effort to go in and delete information. It can't merely happen by the ordinary functioning of the device. And this, I think, illustrates the data storage nature of cell phones, what they become, rather than simply communication devices, which is, again, why they need to be accorded greater protection more along the lines of the Fourth Amendment protection granted to computers. The vehicle exception does not apply because the cell phone is not a container, as contemplated by Acevedo as a vehicle search, or under Belton as a search incident to arrest. Simply put, data is an abstraction. It's not a physical object that can be contained in a container. A physical object in a container, under these exceptions, could be anything. It could be dangerous to officers. It could be a gun. It could be explosives. Data cannot be dangerous to officers. It is easy for officers to peer inside a container and simply determine what's inside. To access data, the device has to be manipulated. Buttons have to be pressed. Menus navigated. Perhaps a password entered. It is best not done in the field, but preserved for later review in a lab or at least a station house. There is every reason to consider such an intrusive search to be as a separate search and not merely one that is capable of being subsumed as a container under a vehicle search exception or a search incident to arrest exception. Finally,
if someone is arrested, this is maybe hypothetical, but if for whatever reason they're stopped, would there be some reason where they could say, okay, you're free to leave, but I'm keeping your phone without looking at it?
We're not contesting, Your Honor, that a officer has the right to seize the cell phone while waiting for a warrant in such a situation as that, because that's, if somebody's being arrested, then that's dealing with this cell phone as a physical object. Obviously, that can be, taken into custody to prevent data destruction.
You got that in your hand. You can go get a warrant. I'm just asking.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Then you'd go get a warrant.
So even though they're separated, they're not tandem. You could separate from the phone. It's kind of like the dog sniffs the suitcase at the train station and says, "You're free to leave, but we're keeping your suitcase." I'm just being hypothetical here because I don't know where we draw the line, that's all.
Well, Your Honor, I think that these courts have regularly dealt with these issues in the computer context. The legions of cases, especially child pornography cases, where, a warrant is required to search that computer, but officers are allowed to take the reasonable steps to make sure that that data is not deleted, altered, or destroyed in the meantime.
But you distinguish the pager, because that can easily be deleted, I guess, with just push a button or something like that.
I think the distinction with a pager is not that it's at a danger of being actively deleted.
Yeah. A minute.
Okay.
Is that for an entirety?
It's less than that.
But if it being passively deleted, that is, if a new, if you have a pager that has a capacity of 10 phone numbers and someone else calls, you've lost the 10th phone number. That's a much different case than we see here. That's an automatic exigency. That's not a risk of destruction, which is what I think the difference is.
You want to reserve what's left, which may not be much.
Yeah. At this point, Your Honor, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Byington.
Good morning. May it please the Court. The first thing that I would like to do is to correct a factual misstatement that's surfaced in the reply brief that counsel for Mr. Moody filed and surfaced to some degree during the argument before the Court. In the reply brief, Mr. Moody's counsel indicates that the record compels the conclusion that the police had no idea Moody might be linked with Gonzalo Gutierrez in a large-scale methamphetamine distribution operation until they found his contact information in their illegal warrantless search of Moody's phone. After this discovery, they knew to conduct the 2009 traffic stop of Gutierrez and subsequently subpoena cell phone records. This Court asked some questions about what happened between 2007 and 2009. And, of course, in this case, the record isn't as nice and complete as we'd like it to be because there is no motion to suppress filed. There is no objection to the admission of this evidence at trial. So there wasn't the opportunity to elicit that type of evidence in a formal proceeding. And I don't want to go beyond what's in the record because that's, of course, improper. But here's what is in the record. That in 2007, Mr. Moody was arrested in Illinois and, of course, his cellular phone was searched. In that cellular phone, in the contact book, there is an entry with the letter G and a phone number with the 317 area code. Then there is something that happens between that stop and the subpoena. On March 27th of 2009, the DEA and the local task force have an informant speaking with Mr. Moody. It's all recorded by a concealed camera. And Mr. Moody gets a call and says basically, hey, I need to go see my supplier. The police follow him then to a gas station where he meets an individual who turns out to be Mr. Gutierrez. Gutierrez is then followed eastbound toward Indianapolis, stopped, money seized. Now, a couple interesting things in the record. The first thing is Detective Dooley, who did the surveillance where Mr. Moody meets Gutierrez at the gas station, is asked, what did you see? And he says, a Hispanic male. Okay. The record indicates he doesn't even know who Gutierrez is at that point beyond being a Hispanic male. Then later the traffic stop occurs. And for the first time, the record indicates for the proceeding, Mr. Gutierrez is identified. Then what happens after that? In October of 2009, so we're 4.5 months after the traffic stop, that cell phone number for G, the 317 area code, is then subpoenaed. The subscriber comes back as Gonzalo Gutierrez. So the statement that the government that's in the brief, that the government first learned about Gutierrez through Moody's cell phone search in 2007, is absolutely unsupported by the record, and given the record, it's false. So I wanted to make clear, I'm not sure how important that fact is about when he was identified, But that's the record, and that's what happened, and we can't just fill in and come up with a story to suit our own needs and explanations in this case.
So you're saying because it wasn't raised below the motion to suppress and everything else, it's plain error?
Yes, and then the plain error...
Would it be harmless error if it is error?
The plain error standard applies in this case, but there are several things. First, when we consider the plain error standard, we have to ask ourselves whether there was any error. In this case, of course, there's no objection, no motion to suppress. The district court in this case, had there been an objection at trial, the district court could have, of course, under Rule 12 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure, said, well, there's been no motion to suppress filed. I'm not even listening to you. In it comes, and we're going ahead. But even if the court might have considered that and, you know, maybe convened a suppression hearing on the spot, I think at that point we say there's no error because the vehicle search exception applies. And the cellular phone, the Fifth Circuit and the Finley case that I cited ruled that a cellular phone was a closed container, at least with respect to call records and text messages. I don't want to go into this smartphone type of analogy where we're accessing emails and things, because I think there's a different standard perhaps with that type of record. But
well, that's what I was just curious, what they got and what they did with it.
That's right. And in this case,
basically,
all
there's nothing in the record other than they got a letter and a phone number.
Yes,
and for 2 years there's nothing.
2.5 years, nothing. So the Fifth Circuit in Finley ruled that the cellulophone was a closed container. And in this case, one of the cases cited by Mr. Moody's counsel that a cell phone is not a closed container is State versus Smith, the Ohio Supreme Court case. And the basis of the Smith ruling was that the Ohio Supreme Court said, and I quote, that a closed container is, quote, physical objects capable of holding other physical objects. The Ohio Supreme Court didn't see room for electronic storage. It was simply a physical type of thing. This court in the Ortiz case, though, took a position with respect to a pager that's at odds with the Ohio Supreme Court. This court, in looking for at a pager and citing the Chan case and following the Chan case, made it clear in that case that a pager should be considered as a closed container. So even though something's holding electronic information, it can still be a container. So the position that this court took in the pager in the Ortiz case is counter to the view of the limited view of a closed container that the Ohio Supreme Court case took. So I think that this court, if it follows Ortiz in the rationale, should, is it a position where Smith completely contradicts this court's view? So I think that when we look at cellular phones as a closed container, they can be a closed container with respect to things that are contained within the memory of the cellular phone. In this case, we're looking at an address, an electronic address stored in a phone. A similar type of thing might have been a text message that's stored within a phone. Now, counsel for Mr. Moody's correct that when we get into a situation with a smartphone, smartphones are more like computers. We get different types of things in smartphones. I'm with the court. I'm not really that technologically savvy, but my 16-year-old is. She has a smartphone. It has a Facebook application. You can push a button and access a Facebook account. if this case would have involved that type of access, then the police are getting information that's not stored within the cellular phone. It's stored somewhere else outside of the phone, and they're using the phone to get access. Smartphones present different cases than this case. In this case, and again, the record wasn't developed at all about what type of storage capacity this phone had. It wasn't developed at all about what could have been done to erase the memory of the phone while the police might have been applying for the search warrant. It wasn't developed at all because there was no motion to suppress or objection. But the phone was admitted into evidence. This court's free to examine it. And although the people at Motorola might not like the classification, this was a dumb phone. It's not a smartphone. And what was accessed out of the phone was simply an electronic address that's stored in the memory of the phone and is similar to something you'd find in a container. Very similar, excuse me, to the record that was found in the memory of the pager in the Ortiz case. The other point I'd like to make is, I don't see this as being the only evidence connecting Mr. Moody to a large conspiracy. So when we consider plain error, we ask, did this affect a substantial right of his? Did it have an impact in this case? And I'd ask the court to look at the weight of the evidence. We had two people who were members of the conspiracy, Misty Sutton and Donald Blair, testifying against him. Ms. Sutton was part of the conspiracy back in 2007. Mr. Blair was also, to a lesser degree at the time Misty Sutton was, and he became more prominent after the arrest in Illinois in 2007. So we have had the testimony of two other people about the conspiracy. We had the controlled buy on May 27th, which I talked about in the beginning. He gets the call from the source, goes out, meets Gutierrez. Gutierrez is interdicted going eastbound. Moody comes back to the informant's house, delivers him 1 1/8 ounces of meth, which is captured in videotape. That's pretty strong evidence of his conspiracy with Gutierrez. And then Mr. Blair talks about a lot of other deals that Blair engaged with Moody prior to that. And even if this is suppressed, with the conspiracy charge, the evidence is, of course, available at sentencing. The last thing I'd indicate to the court, there are two counts here. He was sentenced to 292 months in the conspiracy charge and 292 months on the distribution charge on May 27th. So if the court does exactly what Mr. Moody wants you to do here, find that somehow the district court judge should have looked past the fact that there wasn't a motion to suppress, there wasn't an objection, and said, hey, I'm going to keep this stuff out. If the court goes as far as dismissing the conspiracy charge in this case, he's still looking at the same identical sentence of 292 months on the distribution charge. So to me, it's very hard to even consider the argument that this search affected his substantial rights or should undermine the public confidence in the judicial proceeding. So based on that, I don't... that's the number two. I guess there's 2 minutes or I'm not doing a very good job, I guess. But
yeah, 1 minute now.
1 minute. So I don't have anything else unless the court is in question.
See, you don't have to use it. It isn't constitutionally required to use all your time.
Yep. So I won't if that's all right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. response?
Quickly then, Your Honor. Contrary to counsel's point, how indeed did the police search a cell phone in 2007 for a person they only knew as a Hispanic male in 2009? That doesn't make any sense. There must be some other explanation that is not in the record. The government only knew the number to search for because of the 2007 traffic stop. They couldn't subpoena records without that phone number. Counsel speculates the sentence would have been the same if Mr. Moody was sentenced as a part of this large conspiracy rather than simply a small-time dealer. That's pure speculation, not even convincing speculation at that. And finally, counsel says that this was a dumb phone. That is not in the record. What we do know is in the record is the phone was smart enough to store from Mr. Moody's address book, and that is enough to warrant Fourth Amendment protection. For all these reasons, and if there are no further questions, Andre Moody respectfully requests this court to vacate his conviction below and to grant him a new trial.
Mr. Mounts, you took this case by appointment, did you?
I did, Your Honor.
You have the thanks of the court for your fine representation of your client.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be taken under advisement. And